coffee I take tea, my dear.
Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Rock Review. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about rock and roll music from such sources as the News and Observer, The Week Magazine, The Independent, New York Times, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly.
I'm an Englishman in New York. Whoa, I'm living. I'm a legal alien. I'm an Englishman in New York.
This opening number, whoa, I'm an Englishman in New York, is brought to us by Sting. And we'll be hearing more about and from Sting later on in today's program. But first, these trivia questions.
Someone said, he's the hero of the day. Takes a man to suffer.
Our trivia questions come to us today from IMDb.com and from the ClassicBands.com series, Who Sang That? Question number one, which famous rock star started out as a bus conductor and a tax officer and now resides in the Malibu house formerly owned by actor Larry Hagman? Hint here, he recently said, there is this whole universe of music that is simply limitless. When you think you know everything about music, you discover you can't get to the end. I'm on this lifelong journey, and orchestral music is where it's now taken me. The hint here is the orchestral music. Question number two, what was the name of this number three song from 1959 sung by Miss Toni Fischer? What's the name of that song? Answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. The transition section of today's program, Today in Rock History, is brought to us by BGORecords.com, and today is the weekend of November 5. What were the number one hits this weekend? Well, back in 1961, you may remember, it was Jimmy Dean, Big Bad John. And 45 years ago this weekend, it was the Rolling Stones with Get Off of My Cloud at number one. And back in 1966, a year later, it was the Monkees, Last Train to Clarksville. Back in 1968, it was Joe Cocker with A Little Help from My Friends at number one this weekend. And back in 1983, Billy Joel, Uptown Girl. And finally, back in 1988, it was the Beach Boys' Kokomo at number one this weekend. If you were born on November 5, you share a B-Day with Art Garfunkel. He was born on November 5, 1942, and Graham Parsons, 1946, November 5, and Peter Noon of the Herman Hermits, back in 1946, that same year, November 5, and David Bryson, Counting Crows, 1961, November 5, and finally, John Greenwood from Radiohead, November 5, 1971. Deaths on November 5th include Art Tatum, the jazz pianist, 1956. And Johnny Horton also died on November 5th, but 1960, Battle of New Orleans. And if you were born on November 6th, you share a birthday with Glenn Frey of the Eagles. He was born on November 6th, 1948. Miscellany in rock history this weekend, well, 45 years ago this weekend, we had the famous electricity blackout in New York City. Bob Dylan, Robbie Robertson, and Brian Jones get together and jam through the night at the New York Hilton Hotel. And back in 1973, with this weekend, a performance of Quadrophenia by The Who at Newcastle City Hall is halted after Pete Townshend attacks the group sound man, Bobby Pridden, who plays a tape section 15 seconds out of sequence. And finally, back in 1988, the Beach Boys' number one hit, Kokomo, establishes a new chart record, the longest gap between number one hits. It was 21 years, 10 months since Good Vibrations.
Aruba, Jamaica, ooh, I wanna take ya. Bermuda, Bahama, come on, pretty mama. Key Largo, Montego, baby, why don't we go? Jamaica, off the Florida Keys.
In contemporary music with a local connection, we see this article published in Entertainment Weekly on the 30th of July, 2010. Who's cooler than Mike Posner? This article was written by Simon Vazik Levinson. The Duke grad, 22 years old, Mike Posner, wrote his smash Cooler Than Me to get back at a snooty classmate. We asked him to name some people and things he really does look up to. Number one, my dad. Posner inherited his party skills from his old man. He raged pretty hard in the 1960s. There were many Grateful Dead concerts that were attended by my father. Number two, Jim Morrison. His nickname was the Lizard King, enough said. He's just the man. Number three, the iPad. This nifty gadget is a must on the road. It wrote me a song, and I fell in love with it. I don't know how it can do anything. And number four, LeBron James. I can only dunk from the free throw line, but I hear he's been taken off from like half court these days. This next article was published in the News and Observer on the 10th of October, 2010, entitled Timberlake's Bringing Sexy Back to Vinyl. Justin Timberlake says he thinks vinyl records sound better than digitalized tunes. The 29-year-old pop musician and actor told German newspaper Frankfurter Rundschau on Thursday that he loves putting on records featuring oldies from the Beach Boys and early Beatles, claiming they sound warmer and more vintage than digital versions. Still, he acknowledges that MP3 files are handy for selling his own songs online. This next article is brought to us by Josh Schaefer of the News and Observer, published on October 4, 2010, entitled Kin Owns Elvis, Not His Lifestyle. Smithfield. Elvis Presley's stepbrother rolled up to church in a blue Cadillac SRX. He stepped to the pulpit in a pair of brown leather cowboy boots. And as the congregation fanned itself Sunday night, Rick Stanley pounded a phone book Bible and explained how he had traded one king for another, how he dropped easy sex, handout drugs, and Las Vegas flash for the life of an itinerant preacher. Here was a man who grew up in Graceland, jetted between Beverly Hills and Palm Springs, knocked about with the likes of Led Zeppelin and Wayne Newton, a man so trusted by Elvis that he fetched the king cheeseburgers at midnight. And the lesson he carried away, the news he brought the flock at St. Peter's Church of Christ, was this. Elvis had too much. People aren't built for that kind of wealth. Live simply and kindly. I've heard enough about Elvis, Stanley shouted, going red in the face. I don't care for idol worship. He's my brother, and I love him, but I don't use his name to draw attention to me. I use it to draw attention to Jesus. This was happy news at St. Peter's, where some of the parishioners hadn't been alive half the year since Elvis skipped the planet. Still, us older people remember Elvis, amen. Bishop R.W. Johnson, St. Peter's pastor, said from the pulpit, Jailhouse rock, blue suede shoes, that man could sing, amen. These days, Stanley works for love offerings, trying to make $1,000 to $1,500 a week, but showing up free if he has to. God, he says, trusts him with his story, and he intends to tell it right. First things first, Elvis resides in heaven. At five, Stanley was already living the tough break life of a Memphis bluesman might describe, beaten by an alcoholic father, shipped off to boarding school, and fed Tabasco sauce for punishment. He and his brothers endured their exile for a year until one day their mother pulled up in a Lincoln Continental alongside a stranger she introduced as Daddy. The stranger was Vernon Presley, she explained, a beau she had met in Germany while divorcing their ne'er-do-well soldier father. He was driving them to Graceland to live with his boy, Elvis, the king of rock and roll. This was 1960, and Stanley walked into a palace of gold records and armed guards. He grew up as Elvis's little brother, 18 years younger, catching footballs with the king, selling his faked autograph for $5 a pop. Then, when Stanley turned 17, Elvis took him on the road, welcomed him into the entourage. This was not the Elvis of Sun Records years, not the man who shook his hips to Heartbreak Hotel. This was an aging star living on uppers, downers, and leggy female fans whom Stanley would often fetch. "He used to kid me," Stanley recalled. "He'd say, 'Rick, there's only one thing better than a 5'8" blonde.' I'd say, 'What?' And he'd say, 2 5'8" blondes." But Elvis had a quiet, humble side, along with his kit full of drugs, which Stanley sometimes carried. Elvis kept a green leather Bible, also Stanley's to tote. They'd watch Rex Humbard and other Sunday morning TV evangelists together, and those are moments Stanley misses most. The greatness of Elvis Presley was not singing, Stanley said, but the godly ease he moved with around people, making them feel special, happy with less. To hear Stanley tell it now, he's got less ego in his cosmos and less money. All he misses from the glitzy days is flying first class. He'd rather find a tattooed kid or a girl with a nose stud and make those feel welcome in the pews. Elvis's hips may have been the devil's disciple with the church crowd, but he could sing a good gospel song. He read his Bible, and he loved his mama, and that's enough for Rick Stanley.
Jail. The prison band was there, they began to wail. The band was jumping and the joint began to swing. You should have heard those knocked out jailbirds sing. Let it rock. Everybody let it rock. Everybody in old sailboat.
So what do you know about today's featured artist, Sting? This biography comes to us from www.imdb.com. Born in Newcastle, England in 1951, the son of a milkman, Gordon Matthew Sumner, grew up in the turmoil of the shipbuilding industry and wanted to become a musician very early. He played cruise ships, backing strippers in cabarets, and developed a love for the bass guitar. Having played in jazz rock bands like Last Exit and other various groups, including a Dixieland jazz group, he received his name Sting from his striped soccer sweater, in which he looked like a bee. Primarily a musician, he worked in the band The Police with Stuart Copeland and Andy Summers until 1984, when he went solo. Before his music career, he was a ditch digger, a school teacher who taught English, and a soccer coach. He received an honorary doctorate of music degree from Northumbria University in October 1992 and from Berklee College of Music in May 1994. He plays guitar, bass guitar, mandolin, piano, harmonica, saxophone, and pan flute, and he gave a name to his bass, Brian. Along with his wife, Trudy Styler, and a Brazilian Indian, he started the Rainforest Foundation in 1989 to help save the rainforest. Sting owns a Jacobean castle in Wiltshire, which he calls Lake House, where he records his albums, a place in London, an apartment in New York, and a place on the beach in Malibu, California. He's been called pretentious and is accused of intellectual arrogance for stepping into territory not usually covered by pop stars. Some trivia. His favorite music is actually jazz. He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a member of The Police on 10 March 2003. He wrote Every Breath You Take after waking up in the middle of the night from a dream. His album with The Police, Synchronicity, was the album that finally knocked Michael Jackson's Thriller, the best-selling album of all time, out of the number one spot it held for most of 1983. He's the winner of several Grammy Awards beginning in 1980 and running through 2003. He was inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame in 2002. Here's a couple of personal quotes. "The geniuses of music like Bach, Johann Sebastian Bach, and Miles Davis used silence beautifully. They were not about using as many notes as possible. They knew that playing almost nothing can be the most elegant and eloquent thing to do." And finally, "You can scratch the surface of my songs pretty lightly, and you'll find someone who wanted to be James Taylor at the age of 14. He's also a brilliant and ridiculously underrated guitar player and blessed with a voice that could melt ice caps." Well, aren't we special? We happen to have Sting here in the recording studio today for an interview. Actually, this is Ernie B. reading the Sting part in an interview that was done for the album Symphonicities, and it was done by Neil McCormick on the 8th of July, 2010, and published in www.telegraph.co.uk.
I don't need everyone to love me. I really don't.
The 58-year-old superstar is preparing to go on stage with the Royal Philharmonic Concert Orchestra, augmented by his own four-piece band, to perform orchestral rearrangements of songs from his back catalog. This, as Sting knows, is exactly the kind of thing that makes his detractors groan.
For some people, I'm a pretentious prat. But they're not people who actually know me. I don't feel like defending myself that much, so I'd rather say, that's fine. Believe what you want to believe. I live my life.
The crowd taking their seats at an open-air auditorium in Atlanta, Georgia, seem in a giddy mood, chattering noisily as 45 black-clad classical musicians take their positions on stage, the warm air filling with the hum of tuning. Beer and hot dogs are being liberally consumed.
It's a bit of a picnic atmosphere. It's not easy for the audience on this tour. They can be a bit wary. They're not sure if they should stand up or sit down or be rowdy or be attentive. But by the end, they'll figure it out.
It is easy to appreciate his fans' confusion. In the past 4 years, Sting, a.k.a. Gordon Sumner, has toured small venues with an album of Elizabethan lute music, Songs from the Labyrinth, 2006, and a folk and choral set of old carols and hymns, If on a Winter's Night, 2009. In between, he played to 6 million people in stadiums and arenas around the world with reformed pop rock trio The Police. Tonight, we will be treated to a slow-paced version of the yearning Police classic Roxanne, replete with a mournful cello solo.
Roxanne, you don't have to put on the red light. Those days are over, you don't have to sell your body to the night. Roxanne,
it's easy with a rock band. The audience is bombarded into submission. They can't hear themselves talk, so they don't talk. With this, you have to engage them on a different sonic level. You really have to work harder. But that's okay. I don't expect things to be given to me on a plate.
But there is a flash of the familiar self-confidence, a sense of professional assuredness that some mistake for arrogance.
I know that at some point in the evening, I will have him.
And so it proves. By the time darkness has fallen and Sting is delivering a poised, perfect vocal to a lush, sinister moon over Bourbon Street, you could hear a pin drop. In a set balanced between radically rearranged hits and surprising reinventions of curious corners of his back catalog, Sting and his orchestra seem to be enjoying themselves almost as much as the audience.
There's a bit of cabaret. It's a little bit middle of the road, but I'm trying to create something new in this interface between pop and symphonic music. I think these songs have enough harmonic movement in them to warrant a symphony orchestra playing them. I want them to sound like a rhythmic unit, as opposed to oral wallpaper for somebody's vanity. It's sonically rich. You can do almost anything with an orchestra. I don't know where it's going, but that's something I love. The journey itself is the reward.
He has recorded an album of highlights from the set, Symphonicities, just released this summer, which he says is the easiest he's ever made.
The album was an afterthought. We were rehearsing in Abbey Road and basically pushed the record button. Instead of coming in with a few chords for a band and teaching everyone the song and finding an arrangement by trial and error, you put a score down in front of an orchestra and they play it. It took about the same time to record as it takes to listen to. I think I'm going to make every album like that in the future.
She's too good for me.
jokes I make. She don't like the drugs I take. She don't like the friends I got. She don't like my friends or not.
It may not be what the mass audience wants to hear from him, but you can sense Sting's relief at being in this most musical of contexts, in contrast to the ego-clashing, record-breaking, superstar Police reunion.
I had an instinct that it was the right time to realize that asset, and I was right. But it wasn't easy. There was nothing new in it. No new songs, no new energy. No desire to take that as a platform and move somewhere else. It was purely an exercise in nostalgia. People reacted to the Police coming back as if Mum and Dad had got together. You could see that emotion in the audience. But who really wants to go and live with the wife you divorced? I won't do it again, but I don't need to. I've done it now.
Sting's global fame over three decades has made him part of the fabric of popular culture, yet his musical journey has been far more wayward than his household name status implies.
Before the Police, I played in Dixieland jazz groups and cabaret. I played cruise ships and big bands. My route was very convoluted and almost ridiculously off the beaten track. Music should be its own reward, whether you are playing to your pussycat or 10 people in a pub.
This is what he's always told his own kids, two of whom have musical careers, son Joe Sumner, 33, with the band Fiction Plane, and now daughter Coco Sumner, 19, as a hotly touted solo artist. I blame Coco.
Of course, they say, that's easy for you to say, but I'm still telling the truth. You play music because you want to play it. If you have a choice, it's always been rewarding for me. I was a very solitary musician when I was younger. In fact, I wouldn't speak. I had a guitar, and I would go in a corner and just play it myself.
Sting talks thoughtfully and in some depth about his issues that matter to him, whether they be political, musical, or personal. He is affable, polite, and respectful towards the people around him. He speaks with real pride and affection about his family, declaring,
"Having produced these fantastic kids, I think, well, this is it. My work is done. All the rest is just passing time."
He practices yoga and plays music every day without fail.
"I like discipline. I couldn't live my life any other way. I'm not sort of a Jack Daniels party animal."
So that's Sting. Handsome, healthy, rich, famous, talented, intelligent, socially committed, artistically adventurous, and doing a job he clearly loves. No wonder so many people seem to hate him.
"I have a very good life. I play music, I make money, and I have an active life as some kind of philanthropist. And it's all fine. You know, I get enough love and adulation. If everyone loved me, well, that would be boring, wouldn't it?"
Sometimes in the light at the edge of the world, it's a ghost of a ship with his taxi afloat. And night after night she would stand on the shore and dream of the love that she knew before.
Sting will also be closing out today's program, but first, this article. This article is written by Charles M. Blow, NewYorkTimes.com, August 13, 2010, entitled, "Justin Bieber for President? Maybe we should just let the children run the country, at least until the recession's over. They appear to be the only people not bubbling over with anger, anxiety, and frustration." According to a Gallup poll released on Thursday, 70% of U.S. students in grades 5 through 12 say they are thriving, 63% say they feel engaged, and 53% say they feel hopeful. Adults are a bit more bitter. A CNN poll also released on Thursday found that 70% of adults describe themselves as angry, and 69% think things are going badly in the country. In an NBC News Wall Street Journal survey also released on Thursday, 58% of Americans said they think that things in this country are way off on the wrong track. Yes, I know we parents have to pay for our children's unlimited cell phone packages so that they can text until their thumbs are bigger than their forearms, and we have to pay the mortgage so they can continue to hang out in that filthy room with the pizza box under the bed. Meeting those obligations has us racked with worry now that the recession has sucked out our happiness like one of Harry Potter's Dementors. But that's the problem. The recession has made us all so crazy and consumed by insecurities that we can't think straight. We're misbehaving, like we're the children, and in many cases, having to apologize for it. The article skips down. One of the few lawmakers who seem to be having fun by acting like a child is Senator Frank Lautenberg of New Jersey. He is scheduled to have a fundraiser at Lady Gaga's Monster Ball tour stop in Washington, D.C. Lautenberg is 86 years old, but there is no resisting a woman who once wore a see-through plastic dress with a giant silver lobster as a headpiece. Everybody loves lobster. Another is John McCain, who seems to be flirting with the uber-ton Jersey Shore star Nicole Snooki Polizzi after having bonded with each other over tanning salon taxes in June. Snooki was arrested for disorderly conduct last month. This week, McCain told a Phoenix radio station that, "I kind of think she might be too good-looking to go to jail." A wink-wink from the dashing 73-year-old with wispy locks. One bit of advice to Snooki: don't go to McCain's home base in Arizona. The state is hostile to people of your current complexion. So I say Justin Bieber for president. I know he was born in Canada, but since Republicans want to tinker with the Constitution anyway, why not? Besides, I'm not sure many would notice the difference. Bieber knows how to draw a crowd, get them all excited, and then break their hearts. For a vice president, maybe they could find a booster seat for Zahara Jolie Pitt. She probably has about as much message discipline as Joe Biden. Besides, we need some African birth certificate drama for continuity.
I'm a new soul. I came to this strange world hoping I could learn a bit about how to give and take. But since I came here, felt the joy and the fear, finding myself making every possible mistake. La 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 la.
So, how did you do on today's trivia questions? Question number one, which famous rock star started out as a bus conductor and a tax officer and now resides in the Malibu House, formerly owned by actor Larry Hagman? Well, the former bus conductor and tax officer, who recently said that despite his rock star status, he is now into orchestral music, is Gordon Matthew Sumner, Sting, today's featured artist. And what was the name of that number three song from 1959, sung by Miss Toni Fisher? I played a snippet of it. The title of that song was The Big Hurt.
Do I have to tell the story of a thousand rainy days since we first met?
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Rock Review. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.
Snuffs a quarter up a thousand times a day and ask her if she'll marry me.